Exodus 23 and 24 as we continue our study. You know, through some real practical application, people don't understand how practical the Bible is and how that it addresses everyday scenarios and situations. We talked about a lot of it in the last couple of chapters, and now in chapter 23, thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. So dishonesty is forbidden. There's a lot of talk about how a certain religion has in its tenets of faith that if lying will progress your agenda, then you can lie. It's part of their beliefs that they can, that lying is perfectly okay as long as it's going to benefit them. Well, obviously, why else would you lie if it wasn't going to benefit you? That's just kind of ridiculous. But God forbids it. God forbids dishonesty. Go down to verse 7. Keep thee far from a false matter. And the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. So God is forbidding us from being around a false matter, a lie, or promoting a lie. And so we need to be very purpose and very diligent in our study and understanding of what is truth, what is right. You know, one of the things that we don't think about is when we repeat gossip, we don't know if it's true. We need to go to the source, and instead of repeating gossip, we need to deal with the rumor and try to settle the matter instead of letting it promulgate and whatever, multiply and grow. And we need to stay away from a false matter, he says. In verse number 2, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. So here, he's saying that we should not jump on the bandwagon. And we see a lot of that, don't we? We see, especially today in our political climate, we see a lot of people who jump on the bandwagon and they promote lies. You know, with no evidence, with no substantiation, they just say, this is what's going on, and it's not true. And we've seen many careers, many lives, many families, even churches ruined because people have jumped on the bandwagon. So he tells us not to follow the crowd, but follow the truth. Also, he says, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many rest to judgment. So once the case is made, we don't need to beat a dead horse. That's not King James, that's Pahokee, all right? Don't beat a dead horse. It's been settled. It's been, look, he says, everybody's wrestled to judgment. Don't speak in a cause. Everybody, you already see how the cause is going. Let me give you an example of this. I was working for a company in Central Florida, and they wanted to expand. And so they signed a lease. The owner signed a lease. And after they signed the lease, they had talked to me about the location, and I drove out there to look at the location, about an hour away from all of our other units. And so I drove out there and I looked at the location, and it was a terrible location. And so I called him and I said, hey, I'm sitting in front of this bay. He said, oh, what do you think? I said, well, have you already signed the lease? And he said, yes. And I said, well, it'll do. I mean, what was I supposed to say? The lease is already signed. So why then discourage what was it's already done? There's no reason to speak. Look at what he says, to decline in a matter that's already been wrestled in judgment. They've already decided it. So there's no reason for us then to jump into it. Look at verse 3. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. Now, this term countenance to us is kind of a different use of the term. But what he's saying is, don't defend a man in his cause just because he's poor. And sometimes people will take somebody's position because, well, they favor him. Well, you know, he's poor, so let's stand on his side. That's not the way it's supposed to go. We stand for right, and we stand against wrong, and it doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. We're going to stand on the side of what's right. And so we don't countenance somebody just because they're poor. Verse number 4. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his animal going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the animal of him that hateth thee lying under his burden and wouldest forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. So what's he saying here? Be helpful even to our enemies. Even to those who wish us harm, we should be helpful even when it benefits our foes. Hard to do sometimes, isn't it? But you know, if we have the ability to benefit somebody, we should benefit them even if they are our enemies. Verse number 8. Thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous. So we shouldn't take a bribe or put ourselves in a compromising situation. Not to put ourselves in a situation where we can't tell the truth. You ever been in that situation? Where you just, you felt like, well, if I say it now, it's going to hurt my standing. Okay? Don't put yourself in a position where you can't tell the truth. Verse number 9. Also, thou shalt not oppress a stranger. For you know the heart of a stranger, seeing you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And this is big. Don't forget where you came from. I could tell you a story about a lady who's a millionaire, successful businesswoman. She and her husband own a million-dollar company, multi-million-dollar company. She drove a nice car, lived in a big McMansion, as they call them, and fine jewelry and clothes. And she would look down on people who were poor. And she was very critical of people who were poor. But see, as I learned her story, and maybe I've shared it with you before, this is a woman who was going shrimping on the weekends to feed her son as a single homeless mother. Dumpster diving to feed her son as a homeless single mother. Got a job at a 7-Eleven making minimum wage where she met the man she married, and the two of them eventually opened a business that became very successful. Yet she forgot where she came from. A lot of people do that. And God says to us, don't forget where you came from. Verse 10. 6 years thou shalt sow thy land, gather in the fruits thereof, but the seventh year thou shalt let it rest and lie still, that the poor of thy people may eat. What they leave, the beasts of the field shall eat. In like manner, thou shalt deal with thy vineyard and with thy oliveyard. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, and thine ox and thine animal may rest, and the son of thy handmaid and the stranger may be refreshed. So everybody needs time off. That's what he says. The Sabbath every week. We need a day off every week. A day of rest. And then every seventh year, here he's talking about letting the land rest. As we go on and we study, there's actually this term called Jubilee. And that seventh year was the time when everything would go back, a reset. So let's say that you owned a slave. Now if that slave was a Hebrew, of course we're talking about the Jews, then on that seventh year he would be free to go. Okay, we talked about this recently, I think maybe last week or week before, about them. They could, though, take that earring, that awl in the ear, and vow that they didn't want to be set free, and so they could stay with the owner and work for him ongoing. But if he was a Hebrew, every seventh year you had to set the Hebrew slaves free. And the same thing here with the rest. The idea is that there every seventh day we need a rest and a reset. A time, you know, the Sabbath is not just a day of rest, but it's a day of holiness. It's a day of reflection, a day of meditation, and a day of godliness, a day of holiness, when we're supposed to reset with God. Not just reset our bodies and reset our minds, but reset our spirits to get recalibrated. And so church, having church every week, though it's on the first day of the week, not the seventh day of the week. That changed when Jesus raised from the grave. So the first day is a day of celebration, the day of the Lord. And we take that day today as a day of holiness and a day of reset, a day of meditation and reflection. In verse number 13, in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. And that's one reason, you know, here he talks about other gods. We're not supposed to even say their names. He doesn't want to hear their names among his people. And that's one reason I don't refer to or mention the name of the devil very often. Number one, your favorite word in all words is your name. How many of you know that? When your name is mentioned, if I call your name, your ears will actually twitch. Just a little bit, but they will. Because you want to hear that. That's scientific. I'm telling you, I'm teaching science tonight. Y'all need to pay attention. Your ears will actually twitch because you like your name. The same thing is true of the devil, wouldn't you say? that we can say all things, but when we mention His name or refer to Him, He's going to pay special attention to us, just like He was called. We were taught that, weren't we? When you were out, how many of you stayed out till dark and then somebody would either ring a bell or call you by your name? Now, if they got to your middle name, you were late. But that's true. And so I don't mention the name of other gods or try not to mention His name. But God said not to let it be named among us. In verses 14 through 17, God says, three times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year. The feast of unleavened bread in verse 15. Verse 16, the feast of the harvest, the fruit of thy labors. And the feast of the in gathering. Oh, there it is. In the in gathering. So three times a year. And what are those feasts? Those feasts are memorials. They're thanksgiving. They're recognition. They're honoring God and blessing and thanking God for what He's given at those three times every year. He said, three times a year, all males shall appear before me. Now, that was Jewish tradition. That was Jewish custom, Jewish law. That doesn't mean we don't go to church more than three times a year. I think some people got that confused, didn't they? They only come to church on Mother's Day, Easter, and Christmas. Three times a year. But He also says this in verse number 15, the last phrase, none shall appear before me empty. So when we come to God, He doesn't expect us to come empty-handed, but something to offer. Now look, that doesn't have to be a lamb or a goat or a pigeon or a turtle dove. It doesn't have to be monetary offering, but we come to Him with something to offer. That's why we have an invitation. At the end of the service, when we say to God, God, I give myself to You. Maybe I'm giving more time. Maybe I'm giving more attention. But we give ourselves to God. Don't come before God empty-handed. He's the King of Kings. In verse 20, behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. So God says, I will lead with an angel. I will send a messenger, an angel before you to lead you. Verse 22, if thou shalt indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to thine enemies and an adversary to thine adversaries. So God says, if you'll be on my side, I'll be on your side. Plain, isn't it? But we have to be obedient. If we want God to fight for our cause, then we must fight for God's cause. And we can't expect Him to fight our enemies if we're standing with our enemies. How can He do that? How can He fight our enemies if we are one of the enemies? In verse number 24, thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor do after their works, nor serve them, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. So as they came into conquering, they were not supposed to allow the old statues, the old idols, the old temples to stand. They were supposed to destroy them. You know, it's one thing for us to, as Americans in this land, as people come in with their new cultures and their new religions, and a freedom of religion to allow them to worship any way they please. But if, say, we were to buy a building like down the road, and we're going to go down there and buy that building, and we go in there and we open up the stage, and we see on that stage, if you've ever been in there, that they've got a whole bunch of idols in there that they worship as Hindus. Now, as Christians, as godly people, we would not say, well, that was already there, so let's leave it. No. If you buy a house, let me get a little, I know this is going to step on some toes maybe. If you buy a house and there's a Buddha in the garden, take the Buddha out. Because that's an idol. And you say, well, we don't think it's an idol. It's just a Buddha. That's not a god. And you know what God would say? Don't be superstitious. It's just metal. There's nothing to it. But what God is saying here is remove those idols. Get them out. Verse number 25. And ye shall serve the Lord your God, and He shall bless thy bread and thy water, and will take away take sickness away from the midst of thee. There shall nothing cast their young, nor be barren in thy land. The number of thy days I will fulfill. So God will be our leader, our defender, and our healer. Isn't that what he said in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14? If my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, then will I hear, and then will I heal. Isn't that what he said? That's what he's saying here to the back then. And it's still God's way, because God doesn't change. God is God. In verse number 27, and I like this. I don't know if you appreciate this, but look what he says. I will send my fear before thee, and destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and will make all thine enemies turn their backs to thee. I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, Canaanite, Hittite from before thee. So what's God saying? God is saying that as long as I am with you, you will have a presence. You will have an intimidation factor. Now, how many of you like to feel like you're intimidating? I don't really want to be intimidating. But if I have an enemy, I want to be intimidating, don't you? If I'm in negotiation, I want to be intimidating. I told you all about that ice cream the other day, didn't I? Lady wanted $15 for 3 ice creams. I said, $15? And she said, oh, for you, $4 each. I said, no, $4 too much. Okay, $3. I said, okay, $3. I mean, she got to make a living, right? But I don't want to be imposing. But if I'm in a conflict, or if I'm in a contest, or if I'm in a negotiation, I want to be imposing and intimidating. And God says here, as they were conquering, moving into the promised land, they weren't yet, but as they would, God said, I'll go before you, and before you get there, they'll be running away. And that's what we need. We need people. Look, when we go to tell people about Jesus, let's say we're going to go visit somebody, and that we know, or at least we've been told, that that person needs the Lord and has not been saved. Before we go, we need to pray that God will prepare the heart of that person. That God will give us the right words, the right phrasing, so that when we go, they are willing to hear us, they're willing to listen, and maybe even not to be imposing, not to be intimidating, but that it's not a contest. I don't like to get into a debate or a contest with people about salvation. I'd rather that God prepare their heart, and that when I show up, I'm able then to lead them in the path of salvation. But God said He would give them the presence of intimidation. Verse 29. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field be multiplied against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee, until thou be increased and inherit the land. God's smart. God said, I will use your enemies to prepare your future. That's good, isn't it? It's good. What if we put a test on everybody we dealt with and say, I'm not going to deal with anybody except born again believers? And you call the plumber and you say, well, are you a born again believer? And you call the electrician and you say, are you a born again believer? And you call the mechanic and the first thing, well, first, are you saved? And maybe you go further than that and you say, well, not just are you saved, are you a Baptist? Well, not just are you a Baptist, are you a conservative? Are you a Republican? Did you vote for Trump? I'm having fun with y'all. But how many rules are we going to lay on people in order to do business with them? Okay? But here's the thing we got to realize is that God put all kind of people in the world, all kind of people that don't agree with us, and God is using those people to prepare the way for us. To prepare the future for us. So God's not going to drive everybody out. What happened if everybody was driven out of this country except conservative Christians? You say, well, that'd be fine country, wouldn't it? But God is using all those other people. By the way, if there was nobody in this country but Christians, we'd all have to leave because we have a mission, a mandate. We're supposed to win souls. And so we got to be dealing with the world. But God is using the enemy to prepare our future. So He doesn't drive them all out, lest the beasts of the field and the field itself be too much for us to handle. Now, in verse 31, and I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea, even to the Sea of the Philistines, from the desert to the river, I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand. But here's the key. Look at this phrase. And thou shalt drive them out before thee. God's going to do a lot for us. God says, as long as you follow me, I'll defend you. As long as you're obedient, I will heal you. As long as you're faithful, I will keep you. I will lead you. I'll drive out the enemy. But in the end, you're going to have to go. You're going to have to advance. God will only do so much for us. I think of my pastor growing up, and he'd always say, you know, you can't stand there with a Diet Coke in one hand and a pork chop in the other hand and wonder why you're not losing weight. Like I said, I don't know how I walked 75 miles this week all around town and gained 5 pounds. I can tell you why, because I ate ice cream every day and pizza. That's right. I ate pizza every day. And that was the name of the restaurant. So, and Ben loved that pizza. We ate that pizza every day. So that's how you gain weight. But how is it? We have to take responsibility. We have to be accountable for our actions. God will go so far, and He will energize our efforts. But He's not going to do it without our help. He's not going to do it without our actions. And He goes on and He says, in verse 32 and 33, don't make room for enemies in your life. When people show you who they are, believe them. The thing that Israel wanted to do, and the thing that right now a lot of people in America are wanting to do, is in order to show how loving and how accepting they are, they want to give people the benefit of the doubt who have already told us plainly that they hate us. Who have already shown us that they despise us. And we had people in Guantanamo. They were set free, and what did they do? They went back to the front lines and started killing Americans is what they did. Every chance they got. When people show you who they are, believe them. And that's what God says in those last two verses. He says, when you conquer the land, tear down their idols, tear down their temples, and don't accept it. Don't allow it to be part of your life. Don't make room in your life for your enemies. You say, oh, Pastor, are you not teaching grace tonight? I believe in forgiveness. But when somebody shows you that they're out to destroy you, you don't have to be out to destroy them, but don't make room for them in your life. That's forgiveness. Let's stand.